Well, thank you for defying Frankenstorm, Sandy, and coming here, and above all, thank you, Harry, for your defiance of Frankenstorm, Sandy. Yes. What we're saluting includes Harry spending the night in Detroit Airport and a number of hours in addition. So it's terrific that he can be here. I'm Dick Miller. I teach in philosophy and direct the program in ethics and public life. As a previous speaker in the series, Larry Bartels, mentioned, Americans say that they think equality of opportunity is just ever so important. For several decades, the Pew Research Center has asked people this question: do you agree that our society should do whatever is necessary to make sure that everyone has an equal opportunity to succeed? And over the past quarter century, routinely, about 90% of the respondents has said, yes, whatever is necessary to make sure that everyone has an equal opportunity to succeed. Larry Bartels' response was, what are these people talking about? And one can see that there's a problem. Differences between families guarantee that everyone won't have an equal chance to succeed. If local schools are funded by local property taxes, by and large, people won't have an equal opportunity to succeed. There's not much support in practice for doing a great deal to reduce those differences that family differences make. There's not a great deal of support, certainly nothing like 90%, for the transfers in tax money that would reduce those educational differences. So we've got a combination of great enthusiasm and great reluctance that poses some stark questions. And they're politically important questions in the president and in the debates. After all, both candidates for president were very clear that an American dream, which they identified with equal opportunities for success, must be protected, and they were very clear, both of them, that they supported educational reform to advance this. So big political questions, right? What's fair equality of opportunity, which I guess is what people really mean? What's the role of education in reducing disadvantages that interfere with fair equality of opportunity? These are also profound intellectual questions. And because of his insight into these questions, our speaker today, Harry Brighouse, is a central figure in American public intellectual life. Harry Brighouse is professor of philosophy at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, where he holds a joint appointment in education policy studies. He's co-director of the Spencer Foundation's Initiative on Philosophy in Education Policy and Practice. In these and other roles, he's one of the leading philosophers shedding light on the nature of fair equality of opportunity. In my view, he is the leading political philosopher, examining in detail the proper role of family life and education in fair equality of opportunity. And he is utterly unique in his powerful combination of this insight into norms with detailed investigation of what works, what doesn't work, and what holds promise in the way of education reform. In sharing this powerful combination, he's written such influential books as Educational Equality, On Education, Justice and School Choice, and Social Justice. He's also the author of many influential articles. One of my favorite, which he's written with Adam Swift, is Parents' Rights, and the value of the family. He is co-writing with Adam Smith a book that, now you tell me, it's imminently coming out.
It's in the final redraft.
In the final redraft. And in question period, you can press Harry if you want on just what that means.
It'll come out with the earliest time possible that a copyright date of 2014 allows. For reasons that have nothing to do with me, but to do with Swift.
Okay. we'll take that passing the buck. And this is, I think, one of the most eagerly awaited books in political philosophy. You know, you would think, since one thing we have in common is we all were kids and we all had parents, that central fact of everyone's life would be at the core of political philosophy and ethics. It hasn't been, and Harry and Adam, I think, are restoring it to its proper place, making their book, Family Values, long awaited. As part of this very special enterprise of combining insight into the nature of fair opportunity with concrete knowledge of the nature of inequality and the prospects of education and family policy, Harry will talk to us today on justice, opportunity, and education reform in the United States.
Thanks. I should just clarify about the book. The reason Swift has some strategic reason for wanting 2014 to be the copyright date is to do with government incentives, that's all. Well, I'm not going to be able to live up to Dick's introduction, I don't think, but I'll see what I can do. Dick told me to concentrate more on the norms that underlie the values considerations that underlie the big debates and big issues, and somewhat less on the policy, and I will do that. My observation about, I will talk about policy some. My observation about policy, though, is that the two candidates in the big election, the presidential election, actually, they have disagreements about higher ed, but their disagreements about K-12 ed are not large. Romney seems to think they're larger than they are. If you read Romney's website, he says that he will do what, and then he describes all these things that Obama has been doing, and then says, unlike Obama, who's been doing, and then says these things that Obama hasn't been doing. I will talk. I think we can make some fairly confident predictions about what will happen, and I'll say a word or two about them toward the end. I start with the slide that's really, you know, imposing. I really like this quote. It's from Jerry Cohen, who was a political philosopher in Oxford. And what it says something about what philosophers do. And so I thought, I'm imagining most of the people here are not philosophers, and I imagine some of you are thinking, why on earth is a philosopher talking about these things? And I thought this would just reinforce that question. This is what he says. He says, philosophers don't know how to compute in general terms the comparative weights of the values, all of which deserve consideration. We're sometimes better than others at identifying distinct and neglected values that are worth considering. We have something novel to say about the ingredients that should go into the cake, even when we can say nothing about the proportions in which they should be combined. And then he says, philosophers sometimes end their article saying, it's a task for future work to determine the weight of the consideration I've exposed, but nobody ever gets around to the further work. They wish they could, but they can't. If I can't even talk about the relative weight of different values, then I'm going to have a very hard time talking about reform. What Dick quoted or described Larry Bartels as saying seems to me to be a nice case in point. When you ask people, should you do whatever you can, should whatever it takes to implement equality of opportunity, they say yes. But as soon as they notice that there are other values that might get interfered with, they are much more reluctant to do whatever it takes. In fact, they probably mean, and they may think that the question means, should we do whatever it takes other things being equal, or should we do whatever it takes as long as we don't sacrifice other important values? Part of my aim today, one of my aims is to just talk about equality of opportunity and talk about why it matters and tell you the depressing story, which you already know about why we don't, how it is that we don't have it. But I also want to talk about another value, a value that is often considered to be in deep conflict with equality of opportunity, the value of the family, the value of successful family life. Dick said himself, you know, if you allow people to grow up in families, you're guaranteeing that you won't get equality of opportunity. I think that's right. And so we need to say something about what the value of the family really is and about how we should weigh it against equality of opportunity. And then we need to say something about what that would mean if we were thinking about actual practices that we're... But he doesn't even get on to saying what we might actually do. All he's gotten to is saying, oh, we've got some values and we can tell you what they are, probably with more precision than could possibly be useful for practical purposes. I sort of think of that as being the philosopher's job. And we can't even give you the weights, and I'm not going to tell you what to do. Okay, so before I go into the actually identifying any values, I want to say something about how values considerations play into our evaluation of policy and our evaluation of the world. I've got just a six-stage sequence, okay, so hold on. First, what you should do is you should try and figure out all the values that are at stake. You do this when you act as an individual. You should do this when you're thinking about voting. You should do this when you're thinking about implementing a policy. You think, okay, what values are at stake in this decision? And you try and identify all of them. Equality of opportunity might be one of them. Equality of outcome might be another. Benefiting the least advantaged might be another. You'll see that I think it is. The family might be another. The next thing you have to do, that's what philosophers are good at. The next thing you have to do is you have to think about what weight they have relative to each other. Which is more important? How much more important is it than any other? Then, and this is why philosophers need social scientists, and I'm afraid social scientists need philosophers, you need to work out how well realized those values are in the world. Now, you can only work out how well realized they are in the world by looking at the empirical evidence. But you can only do it by looking at the empirical evidence if the empirical evidence is actually about how well they are realized in the world. Social scientists can't just go off and, well, they can, of course they can. Social scientists can go off and study whatever they want, but it would be much more useful for us if they went out and studied what mattered, found out the facts about what values are actually realized. So, what do you do then? Then you look at the proposed reform packages. You look at what people are proposing to do, and then you have to make judgments about how well what they're proposing to do will realize the values that you have to care about relative to how well they're already realized in the world and relative to each other. You've got two reform packages and the status quo. You want to know of each reform package which values it realizes better than the other, which values it realizes better than the status quo, and which values it realizes worse, and then you do the weighting. That's four stages. The fifth, work out how probable it is that the reform packages that you're being offered will actually succeed. This is a non-trivial task. People propose lovely reforms. My favorite example, or my unfavorite example, is the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform. So McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform sounded great, looked great when it was passed. The consequence of passing it has made things way, way worse in terms of campaign finance than it was before. Why? Because just about everything good and just about everything good within the package was struck down by the Supreme Court, leaving only the things that would only make things better if the good things were left in and will make things worse when the good things are taken out. are you depressed yet? And then the sixth stage is then you make a judgment. You make a judgment about which reforms, which reform you're actually going to support, and how you're going to support it. Now, usually we're talking about fairly small improvements, because usually in normal politics, with respect to any reform, but even with respect to any government, they're not going to make things much, much better. They might make things somewhat better. I've had, for the last 15 years of my life, I've had at least one young child in the house. And one thing you learn if you've got at least one young child in the house is that it's quite difficult. It's much more difficult to build things up and make them better than it is to absolutely destroy them. A three-year-old can destroy just about everything in your house in about half an hour. It takes months to recreate it, right? Making things better is difficult, and most politicians have very limited space for action. They've got quite stark feasibility constraints. Obama, nobody would have chosen to come into office in January 2009. That's, you know, if you were thinking about, oh, I want a poison chalice, that's what you would adopt. If he succeeds in being re-elected, it will be astonishing, because really nobody elected in who took office in January 2009 should be capable of being re-elected 4 years later, in my opinion. Things were terrible, and things were not going to get much better, and things were going to look pretty bad at the end of those 4 years. Okay. That's the first slide. I've got 40, so we'll be here a long time. The 40 wasn't a joke, the long time was. So we're thinking about, broadly speaking, education reform, or education policy. And I say broadly speaking advisedly. Well, so we need to think about what values are at stake. What values should we be thinking about promoting? I'm not going to argue for any of these. I think that each one of these values, you might interpret it somewhat differently than I do, and then we could have an argument about it. But all five of these values are values that you really think, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, that I think that schools and the education system in general should be aiming at. They should be aiming to ensure that each kid can make a contribution to the economy and can navigate the economy pretty effectively. They should try and make sure that each kid can and is somewhat inclined to be a responsible citizen. Childhood itself, and the fifth one is a bit special because I think that the other four, they go together very nicely. I think that childhood itself is an important stage in a life. I don't know how many years you expect to get in your life, but you know, 18 of them were as a child, and I know that for most of you that's past, so it doesn't seem as important now. But when you're living it, it's important. And you know what schools are like. You all went to school, and what they do in schools is they put you in this room full of 30 people, and you know, one of them's a bully, if you're lucky. Often there's one or two others. Several of them are crazy. Three of them are people who just don't like you. And there's this grown-up basically controlling everything. Now, if we're going to subject kids to that, A, we better have a payoff. There'd better be some gain for them later on. And B, we'd better think about what that lived experience is like and make that lived experience just minimally tolerable and ideally quite enjoyable. Many people here are too young to have listened you all know Pink Floyd's Just Another Brick in the Wall, right? I mean, if you don't know Pink Floyd's Just Another Brick in the Wall, listen to it afterwards. You can, I'm sure, on YouTube. We don't need no education. If you listen to that song, it's not like it was some quirky, weird, rebellious song. What he does in that song is he describes what a lot of schooling was like and was meant to be like. People deliberately made children's lives pretty miserable because they thought that was the way of getting them to have successful adulthoods. Now, if you think about that, there may indeed, that maybe they were right. Maybe there's a big trade-off between adulthood and childhood. And if so, I don't think the trade-off always counts, should always be decided in favor of adulthood. Maybe we should tolerate slightly less good adult lives for the sake of having less intolerable times in school. So I think those are the aims values. And now I sort of think about the distributive values. Now the one, I'm not going to talk about the second, but the first, equalizing prospects for educational success. That's not exactly the same as fair equality of opportunity. In our world, in our environment, it is very closely related to equality of opportunity. It doesn't need to be that you have to be educationally successful to be successful in life, for example. We'll come back to the UK later, but we're blessed with a small group of people, a family in fact, who have no need to be educationally successful at all, because they get to be king or queen or whatever. They could fail all their exams. Indeed, I think Prince Charles came pretty close to most of them, and he still gets to be king, which is very nice. I'll come back to that, but first I want to mention some other values. So when you're thinking about building an education system, reforming it, you think about what we should be trying to get children to be like, but then you're also thinking about how you are going to distribute the investment in the building of their human capital. The idea of equalizing prospects for educational success is that we should invest it so that prospects are pretty much equal, or so that human capital development is pretty much equal. But there are other values. There are some balancing values. So think about the physical and psychological integrity of the person. My eldest daughter just loves school, and she tries really hard. She's not always successful. But she's learned how to try through enjoying school. And the truth is, you'd have to really treat her pretty badly for her not to have enjoyed school. She's just that kind of kid. If they beat her every day, you know, she'd probably complain a little bit. But basically, she'd still be enjoying it. If they beat her a lot every day, then maybe you could make her miserable enough that she'd do as badly educationally as some other kids would. We don't beat her, partly because we want her to enjoy the time there, but also because we care about the physical and psychological integrity of the person, and we care about that. We're willing to give up some equal opportunity for the sake of not beating up my kid, for example. I hope none of you were beaten up in school. It is a miserable experience. The one that I want to talk about most, though, is successful family life, because that's these balancing values. I call them balancing values exactly because we often are involved in having to make trade-offs between these values and the other values I've mentioned. And as I say, the one I'm interested in is the trade-off between this, successful family life, family values if you like, and this, equalizing prospects for educational success. Now, this is how we sort of, I've modeled this on Rawls's fair equality of opportunity by saying that the prospects for success may indeed turn on natural talent and willingness to exert effort, but should not at all reflect family background. If we were in a different circumstance, I would argue for an even stronger variant of this in which prospects should not even turn on natural talent. That might sound like an odd comment, and I can explain it later, but I'm not going to just now. So what I want to do is go in... All right, I'll do one more thing. No, I'm not. I'm just going to flip through and go to the fairness argument. So why should we care about equalizing prospects for educational success? I think there's... I, There's nothing sort of particularly exciting or new about the argument I'm going to give. I think it really, I think it reflects a set of intuitions that we all broadly have. How much weight we give to them will vary. But we understand, first of all, that the rewards distributed in our society are distributed unequally, right? And it's not just income that's unequal. If it were just income that was unequal, well, you know, we could live with that. People who care about money are, you know, shallow. And if it was just money that was being unequally distributed, we'd say, well, you know, some people are envious, other people are not. You know, it's just the luck of the draw. But of course, that's not true. There are much more important things than money that are unequally distributed. Status is very important. The sort of interestingness that goes with with certain occupations. Some people have work lives that are miserable and dull and dreary. They work very hard at them. Other people have work lives that are really fun and exciting and interesting. One of my friends who's a dean says, I think wrongly, he says, well, you know, obviously the best job in the world is being a rock star. That's the bit I can't quite get. But, you know, then the second best job in the world is being a professor. And being a dean is somewhere way down there, is what he said. So explaining why he gave up being a dean to go back to be a professor. But being a professor, you get loads of control over your daily life. You get to interact with interesting people. You get to teach people. You get lots of, once you've got tenure, you get lots of positive experiences. It's an unusual. Surgeons, I think they have an interesting life. Me, I couldn't bear it. You know, sticking your hands in those people and whatever, that just strikes me as revolting. But I gather people think it's interesting and enjoy it. The inequality is socially constructed. I'll say a bit more about that later. But I think lots of us understand this. Education, investment in human capital development, essentially, is a gateway to these rewards, right? It controls access to these rewards, not completely, but very significantly. As I said, you know, Prince Charles, it just didn't matter. I'm kind of a fan of Prince Charles, I should say that, in case this goes on the web. And, you know, you never know how things might go. No, I genuinely am kind of a fan, but, you know, he didn't need any education to get where he is. But most of us do. And the distribution of education itself, again, broadly conceived, investment in human capital development is itself socially constructed. It's not natural that some people, if you think about school funding, I don't think school funding is the greatest proxy for quality, but you think about, we choose how much we invest in schooling. We choose how much we invest in some people's schooling relative to other people's schooling. So in the UK, in fact, the funding system is set, the US, we know the funding system is set up in such a way that if you live in a wealthy suburb and you have wealthy parents, a lot more money is going to be spent on your education than if you live in a, maybe not in an urban area, but in a sort of middle class, lower middle class neighborhood. A lot more will be spent, and not just by your parents, though that too, but by the government. That's a social choice. In the UK, it's the other way around. In the UK, the government spends about twice as much on poorer kids than it does on wealthier kids. It's just a social choice. That's just what I mean by socially constructed in this case. And just finally, we just think that it's unfair if the way the distribution of education is structured it's unfair that if some people are at a disadvantage in the competition for these unequally distributed rewards because less was invested by others in their development. Everybody who succeeds, everybody who is well educated, everybody who has a lot of human capital has that because other people put lots of investment into them. It is not the case that we succeed by our own efforts. Our own efforts are important for us to succeed, but we succeed by the decisions of other people to be kind to us, to be loving to us, to teach us things, to spend time with us, to put effort into our development. And having some people, the appeal of fair equality of opportunity or the equalizing educational prospects for educational success comes from a recognition of that fact. I'll say a word about the social construction of talent, but only a word, because I don't want to go too long. The social construction of talent is kind of deep. So one thing is that whether a characteristic is a talent itself depends on the social environment, or whether we count it as a talent. So I have this amazing talent, or at least it might have been a talent in another social environment. When I was a teenager, because I didn't drink and I didn't smoke and I was essentially extremely dull, I used to sit with other people who did, all of those, well, those and other interesting things, and I didn't have much to do. So what I learned how to do was, with a matchbox, I could open a matchbox, take out a match and strike the match with one hand, it's not easy, in about half a second, which is really fast. Okay, and you know what? Nobody's ever paid me to do that. I think that's a talent. And in another, you know, in a world in which people couldn't play basketball, in a world that was devoid of basketball talent, maybe that's what people would choose to pay people for. But in our world, people choose to watch basketball instead. So that doesn't, in fact, get to be a talent in our environment, but it might have been in another. If you think about it the other way, dyslexia. So dyslexia is a deficit. It's a disability. In our environment, pre-literate society, no problem at all. Actually, in Italy, I believe, not a problem at all. Why? Because Italian is spelt phonetically, and it's the non-phonetic spelling that really sort of triggers the problem of dyslexia. And this is a social choice as well. We could all speak Italian. We do not have to speak English. Our society chooses to continue speaking English. We could speak Latin, which would be more sensible altogether, and then dyslexia wouldn't be such a significant problem. The second way is that which talents are fostered depends on which are valued. So it's not the case that, so I fostered my wonderful talent in match striking. But nobody else was going to bother to invest in that. Other people invest in developing the talents that they at least perceive to be socially valued. Okay, I'm going to flip through the next two slides, unfortunately, because they're quite nice. And now I'm going to ask a little bit about how equal opportunity actually is in our society. So this is... there'll be a commercial break in a second. This is just there are people here who do this kind of study. This is an income elasticity study, and it compares a bunch of rich countries. And all this means is that this is the extent to which the incomes of sons, when they're adults, correlate with the incomes of their fathers, right? And you can see that in some countries, that correlation is relatively low. Denmark, I believe, Belgium is not on this slide, and I believe that in Belgium it's very low as well, although the pre-tax correlation is very high. So the way that the Belgians achieve low income elasticity is through a quite elaborate post-income redistribution system. You'll notice that the US is very unequal, but you'll also notice that my own home country wins. So don't think that you're number one at everything. I know that some of you will say, look, we didn't win that because the UK has this unfair advantage of having a monarchy. And it is true that we do have a monarchy, and that does skew things a little bit. But that was a choice you made, not to have the monarchy. You could have kept on having it if you'd wanted to. I'm not anti-American in any way. I've chosen to live most of my life here, but I always do have this sort of slight resentment about the War of Independence, because, you know, you got rid of the monarchy and then you didn't come over and finish off the job, which is what I would have liked to happen. Okay, so now there's the commercial break. I want to talk a little bit about specifically how equal prospects for educational success are. And so here's the break. This is a book edited by Greg Duncan and Dick Manane, Wither Opportunity. It is very thick. I actually thought I'd left it on the plane. I only brought it to show you. I didn't bring it to look at it in myself. And it's heavy, but it turned out it was indeed in my bag. It contains pages and pages and pages of studies about social inequality and social disadvantage and educational inequality. I think it's sort of become a sort of Bible to some extent. Some of the slides I'll show you, I'll show you three slides, I think, from Sean Reardon, one of which is from his study in here, but others of which are ones that he's adapted from other studies. Guess what? Prospects for educational success are not very equal. For example, look at participation in elite education. So the 150, just concentrate on the first of those, the 150 elite, most elite colleges, most selective. So that includes, it's not the Ivy League plus a couple of schools on the West Coast. It's the Ivy League plus a bunch of schools on the West Coast, plus all of the state flagships that you've heard of, plus a bunch of small liberal arts colleges, et cetera. It's quite, it accounts for about 10% of the student population, the overall student population. The percentage of students in those schools from the bottom quartile of the income distribution is 3%, not 25% as it would be if educational success was not correlated with income background. Now look at Sean Reardon's figure. This is his figure on reading achievement. Ignore the dotted line for the moment. Just ignore it. The red line. What the red line does is it traces, using 13 different data sets, it traces the gap in achievement between, am I going to get this right? Is it the bottom? It's the bottom 10% and the top 10% of the income distribution. That's right, Kendra? Yeah, in fact, it says it on there, so good. And what you see is it wasn't very equal there. But over time, we've seen a dramatic increase in the inequality. In fact, the increase in the inequality of achievement between the rich and poor is just about the same as the decrease in the inequality of achievement between blacks and whites over that same period. And you also just want you to note as well that there's a very sudden, it sort of flattens a little bit, and then it goes up much faster around about 1980, around about the cohort born in 1980. There's a reason why. The question is, what causes these unequal prospects? I don't expect you to hold this in your head, but I will give a test at the end, and anybody who can reproduce this. It's just an attempt to sort of show what we're interested in is the middle. We're interested in variation in income, in student achievement. And government, by the way, appears twice on here. It appears at the top and at the bottom. Variation in student achievement is explained by a whole variety of influences. And I don't know anybody who would claim they knew the precise proportions in which these different influences operate. But school behavior is just one of them. The behavior of the school is only one of these. My guess is that you can only do so much about unequal prospects for educational success using the school. Inequality sets in early. And in fact, it sets in early and in some ways doesn't increase as dramatically as you might expect over the early school years. Children arrive in kindergarten depending on with different levels of mathematical achievement, with different levels of attention and engagement, with different levels of antisocial behavior that track social class. And that's not surprising. It's not surprising because children, there's a reason why poverty, there's a reason why people don't think, I know, I want my child to do well. I've got a strategy, I'll be poor, right? People don't think that. No, many of you have the option to be poor if you want, and you don't choose it. And you don't choose it partly because you don't want it yourself, but partly because it's not a strategy for raising children. Why? Because poverty is stressful. Poverty involves you in a whole set of stresses and problems that money and other kinds of resources can buffer you against. And it involves your children in those things too. And we should, and so when they turn up in kindergarten, they're likely to be less able, for example, to attend to what the teacher is doing. I'm trying to think where to go here because I'm taking too long. That's what my son says. You're taking too long. But what he means is, you know, he wants to watch Iron Man. And it's taking me too long to go and set him up with it because my six-year-old does not yet know how to use the TV. So, disadvantage and advantage are transmitted by a number of different mechanisms. You saw the chart. And again, I don't think anybody knows how to... I don't think anybody knows the exact proportions in which these mechanisms work. But the ones I'm interested in for my purposes are the last two there. Because I'm interested in the family, I'm interested in enrichment expenditures, or more generally, parental behavior, parenting practices. I live in a, is this going to go on the internet? Because if it is, I'm going to be inhibited. I'm not going to be rude, in other words. Okay, so sorry. I can be... Okay, there's a really great book by Annette Leroux called Unequal Childhoods. Many of you probably know it. And she makes a distinction between... She identifies two different child-rearing strategies or child-rearing sets of behavior. She calls one concerted cultivation, which is what she observes among upper middle class white and black families, and the other she calls accomplishment of natural growth, which she observes among working class and poor families. And you can look at the differences here. Language use is very different. In fact, the extent to which language is used is very different with upper class and lower class children. The way that institutions are dealt with is importantly different. Upper middle class parents, when things go wrong for their kid within an institution, they understand how to navigate that institution. They understand how to get their kid into the different biology class, away from the teacher that the kid can't get along with. They understand how to talk to a doctor, talk to a nurse. They understand when their kid has a cavity, what a cavity is. There's sort of one of the most tragic moments in the book is where one of the kids The parents of one of the kids makes it clear after a visit to the dentist that she doesn't know, as the kid doesn't, what a cavity is. There's a sense of powerlessness and frustration on the part of less advantaged parents. Overall, there's a very different sort of way of going about parenting that reaches deep into the family, right? It reaches deep into the, it's part of family life. It's not as though, so one of the things you can't do is you can't go and say to these parents, oh, are you doing concerted cultivation? Yes, that's what I'm doing. Are you doing it comes from a natural growth? Yes, exactly, that's what. People just live their lives, and what Annette Leroux finds is that they live their lives in this way. We all do this. We all make assumptions. We all, not just with respect to this, but everything. We all sort of abide by certain kinds of social norms without really being very critical of them, without really thinking about them, and without necessarily being able to identify that's what we're doing. It's part of, it's second nature, if you like. It's part of our way of life. Sorry, I have to skip the funny cartoon. Oh, I don't know, I'll give you the cartoon. But I'm not going to read it out. I can't tell whether nobody's gotten to the punchline or whether nobody thinks it's funny. This is an illustration of how natural concerted cultivation feels to the people who are engaged in it. Can I move on? I don't want to deprive anybody. This is also from, I think, the paper by Greg Duncan and Catherine Magnuson in this book. It's Magnuson and Wolfogel, I think. It traces changes in enrichment expenditures. The activities that children are involved in, that they use the word activities as if it's some sort of, as if it's like, you know, chewing gum. And this, it's not really surprising. If you, the top income quintile has benefited the bottom income quintile has, the gains of growth have gone really to the very top end of the income distribution in this period, and so it's not surprising. I suppose this is better, you know, they could have just spent it all on cocaine, so they didn't, or, you know, or really nice caviar, but they didn't, they spend it on enriching their children. But again, this is something that's happening outside of school. This isn't private, it's paying for private school. This is something that's happening outside of school, and it's something that you might think it's going to be hard for schools to really fully counteract. Okay. It's not as though, doing all this nice stuff for your children doesn't harm anybody, right? So there are two ways, I mean, you might not be very impressed with one of these ways, but there are two ways in which overinvestment or, you know, the extent of investment in one set of children harms the other set of children. They're a scarce goods. They're a scarce, unequally distributed goods. And to some extent, the competition for those goods is positional. To some extent, it's just where you are in the queue is going to affect how well you do. And the extra investment in my kid pushes my kid up that queue relative to some other kid who therefore doesn't get as much of this good stuff. And again, it's good stuff. This isn't being shallow. This isn't income. It isn't great TVs or something like that. This is including really important stuff. The other way it harms them is that there's an opportunity cost. And I, in one way, you might think this is sort of, well, that's a philosopher saying that we should care about the, I wouldn't have been reading a bedtime story to somebody else's kid. I wouldn't have set up a trust fund for somebody else's kid. No, that's true. But if we lived in less segregated neighborhoods, my kids would be friends with different kids. I do a lot for my kids' friends. I do a lot for my kids' friends. I spend money on them. I argue with them about philosophy. I tell them they're wrong about all sorts of things. I actually have a parent who thanks me for the fact that her child has to think about certain things that are not true. I am kind. I tell them jokes. They get to hear my accent, which they like. If they are different friends, all that investment would be going into those different friends. And if there were non-segregated neighborhoods, that is, if there were socioeconomically integrated neighborhoods and socioeconomically integrated schools, some of those kids would be in my house. There is a real opportunity cost for those kids to this to the way we have things set up. Okay. Well, how might you intervene to try and do something about inequality of opportunity? There are four obvious places. The most obvious place I would have thought would be macroeconomic policy. You might intervene in neighborhoods. You might get directly into families. Oh, and then there's schools. Almost all of our discussion of inequality of opportunity, almost the one tool that we have sort of landed on and decided to use is schools. Duncan and Monane, in their introduction to Wither Opportunity and Ad again, discuss a series of ways that you might intervene, and they identify broadly these four types. And I am not saying we shouldn't intervene in schools. I think there are all sorts of things we could do to improve schools and to improve inequality, the inequality of quality of schools, but they don't seem the most natural, the most obvious place to go. This is a quote from Richard Rothstein, and he just goes through in detail. Poor children in general, not read to aloud as often or exposed to complex language, large vocabularies. Their parents have low-wage jobs and more frequently laid off, causing family stress and more arbitrary discipline. If you're under stress, you do not discipline your kids as well. Any of you who've gone through, who have children and who've gone through sort of curves in your life or kinks in your life where you've suddenly been under stress, you know that you're not as good. It's not that there's something wrong with people who don't discipline their kids well. If you're under stress, we're all like that. I'm going to skip through this. So how would you intervene in schools? Finally, I'm going to say a word about policy, and then I'm going to very quickly say something about the family. So I think this is a consensus among the candidates, and I think this is a consensus not just among the candidates, but in sort of, elite opinion, really. The race to the top really was an amazing success, in one sense of success. What Obama and Duncan were able to do was they were able to use the race to the top to leverage huge amounts of change in states with really not very much money. The federal government has no power directly over education, and so the trick for a federal government is to figure out how to leverage states to do things, and race to the top enabled them. The Chicago's teacher strike was about this, was about using test scores to evaluate teachers. You're going to see that spreading all over to get Common Core standards adopted. I think Common Core standards are a good idea. It's not like this is all negative. But the principal one is that the achievement gap is for schools to solve. Schools are just the tool that we're going to use to equalize opportunity, even though they don't look like they're going to be a particularly good way of doing it. There's very little discussion about the broader environment, and there's also very little discussion. You hear a lot about bad teachers, much less about bad principals, right? Fire bad teachers who you can't fire, bad principals who, in fact, you can fire, no discussion of them at all, or the culture of management in schools more generally. Rick Hess says in Common Sense School Reform that 1/3 of all principals in American public schools are former gym teachers or athletic coaches, which is not a great thing, probably. We do get a lot of discussion of Finland. Okay, so one person knows the Monty Python song, but Finland really, I don't like the discussion of Finland because it doesn't seem to me that Finland is very comparable to the US. There is no other rich country which allows as many children to grow up in poverty as the US does. And it's not the 23.1 versus the 5.3 you should be thinking about. It's within those. If only 5.3% of children are growing up in relative poverty, very few of them are growing up in really, really high concentrations of poverty, of really high concentrations of disadvantage. Okay, so I'm going to skip through. Why do people think we should talk about schools? Rather than the other things? Well, this is a quote from Nathan Glazer. It's from a review of one of Jonathan Kozol's books, and I think it just sort of captures nicely why we have this social consensus in a way that what we should do is think about schooling. Why? Because there's this other value, the value of freedom from state imposition when it affects matters so personal as the future of one's children. The family, in other words, the ability of parents to have some control over what happens to their children, over how their children live their lives, is so important that we are going to resist measures that would equalize opportunity. Schools are sort of outside the family. Schools are places where we can actually intervene. Okay. I'm going to go for 7 more minutes. I already said I was going to go too long, and I've gone too long. And I just don't want to make you feel like it could go on forever. So I will stop at 7 minutes, regardless of where I've gotten to. I don't think this is true. So, in other words, I think in our society, it's not true that the family is something that stands in the way of pursuing equality of opportunity. Properly understood, the value of the family allows us to do many things beyond just changing the way we do schooling. And this is because I think what we need to do is think about why the family is valuable. And when you understand why the family is valuable, you have a slightly different way of thinking about the family. So what Nathan Glazer, I think, thinks is that there's this sort of liberty right. There's this liberty right to have a family. We should be free to pursue things with respect to our children. I don't think that's exactly right. I do think we should be free to pursue things with respect to our children to some extent, but it's because of a different view about how the family plays into justice. So the key idea that Swift and I have been developing is this idea of familial relationship goods. So why is it that children have a right to have a parent? Parents do these great things for children. They safeguard and support their developmental interests. The key way that they're able to do this, especially the emotional and moral development, is why you need a family rather than a community to raise you, is because children, especially young children, really need their lover and their disciplinarian embodied in one person. They need to have, they're looking to the adult who they have most to do with to guide them about how to live in the world. They love the person who they have most to do with. They need somebody who loves them and who loves them and then gives them appropriate guidance about how to respond to the world. Children aren't the only people who gain from having a family. Adults have an interest in being parents. They have an interest in being able to raise children. and their ability. We sort of capture this by talking about a non-fiduciary interest in being able to play a fiduciary role, in fact, of a certain kind. It's really rewarding to raise children in a way that contributes to people's well-being that is not comparable with, it's not substitutable by, other kinds of relationships that we can have. It's not substitutable for most of us by having a cat or a dog, but it's also not substitutable for most of us by having a lover or a spouse. These are really good things that the family produces for both adults and children. And justice cares, tells us to care about the distribution of these good things. So justice tells us that what we should care about is making sure that it's not that there's justice here telling us we should distribute stuff and then there's the family here constraining that. The goods that the family produces, the good of successful family life, is itself part of what we want to distribute. It's part of what we want to distribute more equally. And if you see things that way, you have a distinctively family values justification for objecting to poverty in particular, to relative poverty in particular. Why? Because poverty, which is unnecessary. Look, if we lived in a different kind of society, you might think that poverty was necessary. The kind of poverty we have in the United States is not necessary. It is a social choice that we have made and we continue to remake over time. And it makes it more difficult for those people who face those conditions to enjoy the goods that come to people through having successful family life. There are many interventions, in other words. There are some interventions that would damage family life for those people. But there are many interventions that wouldn't. There are many interventions that would improve family life, make it more the case that they have are able to participate in these great values. So, think about inclusionary zoning. This is one of the things Richard Rothstein proposes. We have an inclusionary zoning statute ordinance in Madison, which requires that all new developments include a certain amount of housing set aside for low-income families. It's not brilliantly successful. It's very hard to monitor. It's very hard to maintain over the long term. But people will object, and they do object to inclusionary zoning because it makes it harder for people to raise their children the way they want to. Why? Because, well, if I want to raise my children among other children who are like my children, inclusionary zoning tells me I have to live in a neighborhood with children who are not like my children. Yeah, that's true. It does restrict the capacity of more wealthy parents to raise their children as they see fit. But it increases the capacity of other people to raise their children as they see fit. Inclusionary zoning doesn't violate a freedom, it redistributes a freedom, if you like. It redistributes the freedom and the goods that are yielded by that freedom. The broader, I've just given a list of broader, bolder programs. Nurse family partnerships have been championed recently by James Heckman. These are usually means tested. They're targeted to low-income mothers, usually single mothers, younger mothers, and nurses enter the home. Nurses give advice. Nurses, to some extent, monitor whether the children are being well treated. But the experience of these nurse family partnerships does not seem to be that the nurses come in and take over and piss off the mothers. What it seems to be, and you know, in Britain we have this, everybody has this experience. This is a universal program in Britain. And what happens in Britain is what happens when it's used here, which is by and large people think, oh, thank God somebody is paying some attention to me. When you first have a kid, it is incredibly stressful. You don't have a lot of knowledge, you don't have a lot of support, and somebody comes in who does have knowledge and has some sort of institutional support and makes things easier for you. Better for the kid, but also better for the family. The Baby Academy, some of you will be familiar from the Harlem's Children's Zone. I really am going to finish. It's part of the set of programs that Jeffrey Canada has put in place. And it's entirely voluntary. Nobody has to go to the Baby Academies. What they do is they recruit, basically, as far as I can tell, off the streets. They recruit people who look like they're about to have babies. And they take, you know, on, they go on Saturday mornings to classes. It's basically, you know, prenatal, is it antenatal? Antenatal classes. But antenatal classes and then also postnatal classes in which parents learn about discipline. They don't, in the antenatal classes I went to, all we learned about was breathing, as far as I can remember. At the moment in the labor when the doctors all ran in and said, we're getting her out of here, we're going to cut her up and take the baby out, sign this, the breathing sort of went out the window. But this doesn't just talk about breathing, it talks about how to discipline your kids well, helps to give people a kind of support that they need in order to not, again, not to defeat or denigrate their family life, but in a way that benefits their family life often. So, I just put this in because I thought, you know, since we're talking about education, K through 12, isn't this a sort of, you know, this is what you have in grade three. You always have a word of the day. And it just happens to be, thank God, it's still October. It seems to be that the word of the month is grit. Grit seems to be everywhere. This is Angela Duckworth, who developed the grit scale. You can go online. If you just Google Duckworth grit, you'll get to her grit scale, and you can find out how gritty you are relative to other people. Grit is this sort of complicated idea of, you know, how, basically how well you form a plan and stick at it. And that's, I just thought you'd like a picture, basically. That's Jim Heckman, who's been pushing the same kind of idea. Paul Tough's new book, How Do Children Succeed, which I think is number one in the bestseller list now, explains this in more detail. Oh, yeah. So I just tell you what won't happen. This is what will happen regardless of who wins the election. We'll have Common Core standards, a good thing. We'll have urban charters. If people come to the workshop tomorrow, we can talk a bit about urban charters. I'm kind of interested in what people think. And we won't get massive reductions in child poverty levels, which is probably a thing which will do most, both for equality of opportunity and for successful family life. I am finally done. Yeah, I do. I want you to call on people.
Okay.
Because you never, you know, you never know.
Okay. So, Harry would be delighted to hear your questions and comments. Only one rule. Would you please stand up and speak loudly because it's the only way to hear you.
Oh, yeah. So that's great. So one of the things, so I totally agree. I don't think concerted cultivation is just a social construct. I think it's a totally bizarre social construct. I don't like, I really find it kind of disturbing. I see it around me all the time and I I mean, it's not just that it's not better than accomplishment of natural growth. A lot of the elements of accomplishment of natural growth just seem like just morally preferable to me. And Annette Leroux is very careful not to say this is better than that. What she does say, and I think it's right, is that in our society, which is screwed up in all sorts of ways, she doesn't say that, this is a better strategy for doing well in the competitions. Sorry? Well, that's right. So it gets, that's right. It gets you, it makes you more likely to get into fancy colleges, but there are all sorts of other ways. And she talks very specifically, there's a lovely passage where she talks about learning to look people in the eye and learning to give a firm handshake. Now, those two things strike me. So there are other things about concerted cultivation. Grit is really valuable. Basically, grit is really valuable whatever you want to do in life. It's just universally a good thing. And my guess is some aspects of this, especially the language use stuff, probably promote grit better than others. But looking people in the eye while you're talking to them and a firm handshake, those are totally social constructions. It has taken me, it's only since I read her book that I've started looking people in the eye. I've been trying for 5 years. It is really hard. My students used to, well, they still do sometimes, you're talking to them and they start going like that. They're wondering what it is you're looking at. And I know people find it unnerving, but it seems to me totally So I agree. If we want to equalize opportunity, though, given that we're not going to do anything about the other ways in which our society is screwed up, and I don't think we are, we might want to do, you know, we might want to shift a bit toward what, in my view, is otherwise not a very appealing way of raising kids.
Yeah. Equality of opportunity. There are these things to help poor people that would be best that aren't going to happen. The macroeconomic things, and there are family interventions which might happen, which should do good. But forget about schools. On the other hand, some of the things that you're talking about seem not clearly external to school. It might be internal, and some, like the Common Core, are internal. What are the prospects of really doing good for fair opportunity within schools?
So Danielle told me at lunchtime that you would ask me for a sort of more, something that wasn't totally pessimistic to say. We're not going to see big changes. So nobody should. One of the things that I think is worst for success over time is to have expectations or aspirations that are unrealistic. What we're going to do is we're going to make, you know, slow progress and small in small ways. It all depends on how the testing regime works out, but in my view, the Common Core standards are basically a good thing. And think about this. So we lack in this country an infrastructure for teachers to learn how to instruct poor children well. Now nobody, the Finns don't, nobody knows how to teach, how to really massively improve the cognitive development of kids who live in high concentrations of poverty. We don't know how to do that. But we don't even have the beginnings of an infrastructure for learning how to do it. And you think about college-bound kids, College Board has developed an entire infrastructure around AP through which teachers learn what works, what doesn't work. They're engaged. It's, you know, College Board is small. It's not government. But for that level of kids, we do have a kind of infrastructure. And I think the Common Core standards, as long as we retain the one really good thing about No Child Left Behind, I know nobody's allowed to say anything nice about No Child Left Behind, but there's one really great thing about No Child Left Behind, which is that it forced schools to disaggregate their achievement. So schools could not carry on looking like great schools because their mean achievement was high while neglecting to do anything for the 10% of kids who were the lowest achievers. Forget them, we're never going to get them very high anyway, and we're still going to look good. The requirement to disaggregate reporting is really important. And if it were coupled with testing that was sensibly done, and I understand there are really, that's a really difficult problem, tied to Common Core standards, I think that could, that would enable us, without spending lots more money, to improve the kinds of instruction that the kids who are in the sort of bottom 50% of the achievement distribution receive. So that would be a really positive thing.
Could you explain Common Core standards and how they avoid what, as a teacher, strikes me as the horrors of teaching to the test?
Yeah. So they don't avoid the, well, we don't know whether. So the tests are not in place yet, so we don't yet know about the tests. The Common Core standards are very detailed. The English and math ones, which we have, I don't know anything about math, but the people I know who do think the math ones are pretty good. The English ones look pretty good. They're the kinds of standards that you probably would want to use. They've been adopted by almost all the states in their pursuit of race to the top dollars, which most of them have not gotten, but they had to adopt this in order to be eligible to compete. Teaching to the test, if the test is good, is not a bad thing. Teaching to the test, if the test is bad, or if the test has these, if you know the same questions or almost exactly the same kind of question is going to come up over and over again, well, then you can teach to the test without actually getting any learning going on. But if the tests are well enough designed, and that's an expensive business, getting people to teach to the test is a good idea. One of the reasons it's a good idea, or one of the reasons that it helps you build an infrastructure around instruction, is that currently the practice in middle and high schools, in large numbers of middle and high schools, is that teachers teach in their own rooms without ever watching anybody else teach, and without really knowing who's doing well and who's not doing well. They grade the work, but they don't know. I don't know a single teacher who has a database of performance over time. They grade the work against the work of other kids. It's very hard to get information about whether real learning or what kind of learning is going on. It's hard to get information if you know you're failing with some group of kids. You can have all the incentives in the world to improve, but you want to know who's doing something that works with those kids, and the only way you can find out who's doing something that works with those kids is by having common assessments that enable you to find out. If the other person is just grading idiosyncratically, you don't know whether what they're doing is working either. So we want some teaching to the test. We don't want too much of it. There's lots of perverse incentives in bad design. But it's not... Look, it could be a horror. It all depends on how it's done. The tests that will be developed around them can't be worse than the tests that we currently use.
They're not going to be much different.
I know they're not going to be much different, but exactly. So it provides lots of information and provides something around which skills can be built. Yeah.
While I'm standing up, though, I think one of the sort of impossible to imagine how that could happen, and so I think it probably wouldn't happen.
So that's sort of what
And then the other one is that Obama, I mean,
So yeah. So I think that's what I meant when I said higher education. I think there's substantial differences, and that's what I was thinking of. Is that, you know, Pell Grants? I mean, it's not just the money. It's also the design. The design might change under Romney in a way that I don't think it will under Obama. Yeah. Yes. So what the states do with the Common Core standards is what's interesting, I think. The reason I discount the voucher program is exactly what you said. I think that's a ludicrous promise, and so I don't take it seriously. So I know it's there, but it's just one of those things where I just sort of think somebody's saying something that they have not thought about how they would implement. I mean, it's just, that's not going to happen. Maybe he'll take Title I funding and do something else with it. I doubt it.
There you go. That's a related question. A few weeks ago, Larry Bartels was here, and he basically argued that the party with the president has real and meaningful consequences for inequality, patterns of redistribution. But you seem to suggest that it might not. So I was wondering if you could reconcile.
Okay. I think the big difference is not through education policy. So if it makes a difference, it won't be through education policy. What we think of as education policy, schools policy, although maybe higher ed. It'll be through macroeconomic policy. It'll be through the way that the tax regime works. It's really good. Jim Heckman says, you know, well, just giving people more money doesn't make them better parents. And that's true. Just like just giving a school more money doesn't make it a better school. But, you know, money really does help. Obama is not proposing that we get rid of child poverty. He doesn't mention it much. He won't reduce it very much. But my guess is that child poverty is, you know, will be less bad under Obama than it would be under Romney. And that really matters for opportunity. That really matters for equality of opportunity. My guess is that employment, the kind of employment that people who have who are in the lower end of the occupational structure, the kind of employment they have, the kind of rights they have at work, probably even their compensation packages, whether OSHA enforces things, those will all be different under Obama than Romney, and those all have effects, not just on them but on their children, right? So it's not that. I do think it. I'm not very partisan. I'd never like anybody who runs for president, really, or many offices. But I think it really probably does make a difference, but not through schools policy. I don't think schools policy is going to be very different, but through these other, more macro policies.
Just as someone's in a more suburban high school city, disadvantaged urban city. I just wanted to get your thoughts on the management aspect of it. So much in school reform talk is about being very punitive towards teachers, holding them accountable for these test scores. And like you said, there's not that much accountability to the management. In my experience, I saw very mediocre management in the more affluent district.
Yeah.
Meant that the achievement, even with all the advantages that you pointed out outside of the schools, wasn't nearly as much better as you might have expected in this much more disadvantaged place that has much better quality management. Mm-hmm. It makes a tremendous difference that things are actually being done in classrooms and they're actually being observed and prepared.
Yeah.
Given
so,
time to work together. And I wanted to get thoughts on how you can improve that.
Yeah, so Richard Elmore has some work on suburban schools, you know, and where, you know, the inner life of suburban schools, and his view is that a lot of suburban schools basically coast, and they coast because they can coast. And I think that the disaggregation of reporting has made it a bit more difficult for them to coast. I think the whole, teachers, it's so easy to blame teachers. There are a lot of them, and it's very hard to fire them, and they've got pretty strong unions that give lots of money to candidates, and so it's easy to sort of attack them. But for all, for those reasons. So for example, when somebody says, I'm going to fire a whole lot of teachers, I just don't believe them. If you want to fire teachers, you do not talk about it. If you're serious about firing teachers, you do not go on about it. You just talk, you make friends with union leaders, and you make friends with teachers, and you make sure that they trust you when you want to fire somebody. Because there's lots of teachers who want to fire some teachers. But where is this pool of alternative labor? Where are all these hundreds of thousands of people who will be the great teachers when we've gotten rid of the hundreds of thousands who are supposedly awful? I think it's really odd, though, that we don't talk more about management. Reading lots of school improvement literature and then just basic sort of simple experience doesn't give me a high. It seems to me there's a lot of room for improvement. I'll give you an example. This is from Richard Elmore, so I won't give you my own sort of more home example again because I don't want it to get out. But Richard Elmore tells about a study that he did in the Bay Area, and they looked in many schools. And one of the things they try to figure out, so there are lots of meetings in schools, and meetings often go on without agendas, and they often go on without chairs, and it's not clear what they're about, and there's a lot of time and energy wasted. And they were trying to figure out, but then they'd come across a meeting where it was chaired, and it was chaired really well, not by a principal, but by a teacher. And they examined where all of those teachers had learned how to chair a meeting. Their church and their union, right? Everybody had that incredibly important bit of human capital that they imported into the school, not from the school of ed that they went to, not from any principal having taught them, but it's a way in which churches and unions and other kinds of civil society groups basically subsidize public schooling. I thought that was kind of tragic. And the truth is, most of the people I know who can chair a meeting well learned it from being in some tiny little left-wing group.
Not mentioning any names.
Oh, okay. You invited us to ask you how you differ with Rawls on natural talent, and if you wanted to get into that.
Uh-huh.
Or, I'll give you a choice, did you want to talk a little bit more about your particular take on charter schools and how that connects back to your interest in parental partiality?
I think I'll go with the first, and the second, I think there's a workshop tomorrow and we can talk about the second tomorrow. So the first is just, so if you,
so Rawls allows the natural talent can have an influence on outcomes. He doesn't require that it does. So it's entirely consistent with fair equality of opportunity that natural talent has no effect at all. It's only that social background mustn't have an effect. But natural talent might. I think inequalities deriving from natural talent are just as unfair as inequalities deriving from social background. They're equally arbitrary. And I also think that there are good reasons to allow both natural talent and, in fact, social background to have some effect. It's unfair, but there are other reasons to allow them to have effect. So we would not want equality of educational outcomes across natural talent. Why? Because they'd be very low. We'd level down a lot, and that leveling down would be fairer. But what we think is that the more talented people can be productive in ways that benefit the less advantaged. We want to increase the pool of the overall pool of human capital, I only want to do that in order that that human capital then gets deployed to benefit less advantaged people. It's no good to me if the people who have the human capital get the entire return to that extra capital. I mean, it's nice for them, but I don't think that's just. But I think there are good reasons to allow. But similarly social background. So despite what I've said, let's go back to Prince Charles. You know, the truth is quite a lot of effort was put and investment was put into his education. And I think he's done pretty well. I don't think there's a huge amount of natural talent there. I think we've got all sorts of reasons for supposing that that's not a family with oodles of, capacity that comes from their genes. Pretty good reasons for thinking that. But it's much better that they invested, much better for society that they invested money in building Prince Charles's human capital than if they'd just used it to buy really, really super nice caviar or cocaine, right? So if rich people if they're allowed to use what they have to invest in their children, and then we can deploy the benefits for the benefit of the less advantaged, I think that's a good thing. It's unfair, though. So I think they're basically parallel.